Okay. All right, any questions from before the break? All right, let me turn, I'm just going to touch upon point one under C, the repeal of farm subsidies, rent controls and price controls on oil and natural gas. This will be an important application of the uniformity of profit principle. I pick farm subsidies as an example of a minimum price control, a price that is set artificially high. The government wants the price to be higher. It makes it illegal for people to sell below a certain minimum. Farm subsidies are similar to minimum wage laws in that you're not legally allowed in one way or another to have farm prices below what the government is aiming at. Rent control and price controls on oil and natural gas are examples of price controls of an opposite kind. Those are maximum prices, prices above which you're not legally allowed to sell. And we can use both kinds to illustrate the uniformity of profit principle and the effects of such controls. Now, the government currently pays to the farmers, I believe, something around $20 billion a year. I may be off somewhat. I saw the figure not too long ago. For the purpose of achieving higher farm prices than would otherwise exist. And the reason for the program, there are still a number of key states with two senators each in which the farm vote is crucial. And the paying of farm subsidies is a way, an attempt to buy a significant part of the farm vote. And the purpose is to enable people to continue as farmers, to remain in business, who otherwise would have been driven out at lower prices, which their costs would be too high to make profitable. Now, let us imagine what would happen if the farm subsidy program were abolished. Here's the government spending however many billions, assume $20 billion. The farmers would now have $20 billion less revenues. And let us also assume the government would reduce its tax collections by $20 billion. I know that may be an unrealistic hope, but let us assume that. So here we are, the government is spending $20 billion less, the farmers are getting $20 billion less, the taxpayers have $20 billion more. All right, how would this affect the pattern of demand coming from the taxpayers? Right, they'd be making an increased demand for a wide variety of things. The sales revenues and profit margins of the industries selling to the taxpayers would be increased somewhat. The sales revenues and profits of the farmers would be very badly reduced. It's possible that all of agriculture for a year or more might be running at a loss. In any case, we have a situation where the rate of profit in a major industry, agriculture, plunges. The rate of profit throughout the rest of the economy is more or less, is modestly increased. It's modest because it's a much broader base. The decline is concentrated. The increase is very heavily spread out. Okay, that's the immediate effect. What would be the further effect? What would happen to the amount of labor and capital employed in agriculture as the result of very low profits or indeed heavy losses? Okay, it would be decreased. The capital and labor would be withdrawn from agriculture. Would there be alternative opportunities for people to be employed and capital to be invested elsewhere in the economy?
Immediately?
Well, within a relatively short time, all those areas where the taxpayers were now spending the money the government had spent. All right, so the effect is capital and labor would be withdrawn from agriculture and more of it would be invested in other parts of the economy. And as capital and labor were withdrawn from agriculture, what would be the effect on production and supply in agriculture and on the selling prices, profit margins, and rate of profit in agriculture?
Supply drop.
Pardon me?
Wouldn't the supply drop?
Production would decline as capital and labor are withdrawn. And so what would happen to the price? It would start coming back up. Initially, it would have been sharply reduced. Now, as capital and labor are withdrawn from agriculture, the price starts coming back up. And what would be happening to the profitability of those who remained in agriculture? Okay, that would be coming back up. So starting from an initial plunge, we would have a withdrawal of capital and labor. That would restore the rate of profit on the agriculture that remained. And the influx of capital and labor throughout the rest of the economy, what effect would that have on the rate of profit elsewhere? Pardon me? And the rate of profit would decline. So here we are. We have an event, the abolition of the farm subsidies. The immediate effect is a sharp reduction, perhaps a total wiping out of profits in agriculture, an increase in profits elsewhere. Then that results in a movement of labor and capital out of agriculture into the rest of the economy. And this goes on until the agriculture that remains is once again profitable and there's no longer a premium profit elsewhere in the economy. All right, what would be the enduring effect? What would remain after the dust had settled? It's not going to be the rate of profit is permanently reduced or raised. It tends to return to normal. But what would be different that would be of significance? The agriculture would have been sharply reduced, and other branches of the economy would have been increased. Now, why would that make a difference? What is the government doing with the agricultural produce that it buys up to elevate farm prices?
It doesn't give you reason to pull capital.
Pardon me?
It doesn't give you reason to pull capital out of agriculture.
No, it doesn't give you a reason, but...
So that means it's staying in place, it's not really...
Well, what is happening to the output that the government buys, or at least did happen for many, many years? It could be stored. For many years, it was simply stored. They ran out of grain elevator space. They were storing some crops in caves, in the holds of mothballed ships, and they were looking for ways to get rid of the surpluses. And then they came up with such things as the food stamp program and food for peace. The one allows the giveaway of food to people within the country and the other outside the country. Now, from the point of view of the taxpayers, what is the benefit to the taxpayers of the food that either stores and rots or is given away free to other people? That's not a benefit to them. If instead of having the production of that food, they had if that food were ceased to be produced and instead other things were produced that they would be buying, well, which is a better use of their income? What's a better use of your income, the share of your income that you presently pay away in taxes every year that the government then uses to buy farm products to store or give away, or that same income spent in a way you individually decide and resulting in a larger production of the things that you individually are buying? What represents a more efficient use from the point of view of the taxpayers of the labor and capital, the part of the labor and capital that's presently tied up in producing the part of the agricultural output that the government buys up? It would be much better producing the goods that the taxpayers want. Mr. Zink refers to the principle of marginal utility, which is a good integration.
That's in the short run.
Which?
To discontinue the subsidies to
the farmers. Well, we're looking, the short run effect is profitability is wiped out in agriculture and enhanced elsewhere. Then the longer run effect is profitability is restored in agriculture and reduced elsewhere, but the enduring effect is there's less labor and capital employed in agriculture, more elsewhere. And the point Mr. Zink was referring to is where would the marginal utility of the output be greater when it's in the form of food products that the taxpayers don't want, or when it's in the form of additional products that they do want? Obviously, additional products that they do want. So,
not taking into account all external social implications of that, correct?
Well, by external social implications, what do you mean?
I mean, they did put it food for peace, which means they do export a lot to Africa, which helps see starving across the rest of the world.
Okay, let's say
the export of goods that they do export to other countries will import our goods. It'll be
okay.
Sold.
Okay.
And the huge impact on one sector of national security of our country, which is supplying ourselves with food, versus the marginal impact, your words, of increasing or decreasing the value of something else, hoping okay. The government will give the $40 billion back.
Okay.
We're preserving now, our farmland so we can say that we have some way to support ourselves in the future, should we have the need to do so.
Well, all right. All right, so you're tying into Mr. Goodrich's point about securing the food supply.
Right.
Okay, now, people could make that point, but let me point out that the market does an awful lot to secure the food supply. And this is a major function of the commodity futures markets. See, it's not the case that we simply have a supply and people are thinking just of the immediate moment. We have a large number of professional commodity speculators who are spending their full time following every development that could affect the demand for or supply of agricultural commodities for several years out. And if anything occurs that can be interpreted as making food scarcer, reducing the supply, or increasing the demand, what does that imply about the prospective future price? The prospective future price will be higher. And if the prospective future price is higher, this relates very directly to the to another topic, the tendency toward a uniformity of prices over time. The price of a good in the present tends to equal its expected price in the future, or more precisely, the expected price of a good in the future tends to exceed its price in the present by no more than the cost of storage and an allowance for the going rate of return. So, you know, you might wonder, the whole harvest might come in for some crops in September. I don't know if that's true of the wheat harvest. I think it is. So let's assume the whole wheat harvest is coming in this month and maybe is part of last month. Does that mean that the price of wheat becomes ruinously low and then we consume it all and next July we have famine? Is there anything that brings about a smooth rate of consumption so that we don't get into a famine situation? Well, just think of the implications. Suppose the whole food supply had to be bought and consumed within a relatively short time when the crop came in.
Like a tomato.
Okay, like a tomato. Now, if the prices were ruinously low in the at the time of the harvest, and then they reached famine levels before the next harvest, if the item were storable in any way, what would present a major profit opportunity for people?
Some of the stores.
To buy the thing as it's cheap, hold it, and sell it when it's dear. Well, that is exactly what commodity speculators do. And what is the effect of their activity on the price in the harvest month?
It
raises the price. And what is the effect of the supplies that they have available for sale at higher prices later? What is the effect of that on the supply later and on the price later compared to what it otherwise would have been?
Lower.
It's lower. The commodity speculators are assuring that supplies are held back from times of relative abundance and stored for times of comparative scarcity. And they're not doing this just for 1 year. If you open up the newspaper to the financial section and turn to the pages where commodity futures are quoted, you'll see that typically there are contracts running at least 2 years out. So you can buy grain futures probably now for months in 2006. So they are paying attention long term. And in minerals, and the prices of agricultural land are a reflection of the longer-term prospects. Mineral companies are concerned with their long-term reserves. They want to have reserves equal to many years' production. So the market takes care of this. What we're talking about is not security for the market, but something different. You see, it's true, if we didn't have enough food, we could starve. But we have vastly more than enough food to guarantee us. And another aspect of what protects us is that our country does not consist primarily of vegetarians. We have a high proportion of meat in our diet. And in order to have the same calories and vitamins in the form of meat, what do you have to have in the way of overall food production compared with relying simply on vegetable products? You need a substantially larger ability to produce. It's estimated that to obtain the same calories and vitamins in a pound of beef requires something on the order of 9 times the capital and labor as required to obtain it in grain products. And so this means that if we have any difficulty, the worst effect is that there'll be some reduction in consumption of meat, and there'll be more grain going to human consumption. So the market is, you never have a famine in a modern country. You have famines in third world countries, or would in the absence of our intervention. Now, someone, I believe it was Mr. Goodrich, referred to our ability to provide food for Africa and so on. And it's certainly desirable that people who otherwise would starve should get food. But as a matter of practice, what do you think happens to a lot of this aid? Unless it's government-to-government aid. So, pardon me?
Corrupted.
All right, it's corrupted. So the American government is giving some African government the aid, and what do you think the local politicians are probably doing with the proceeds? They're selling it, so we're giving aid to government officials. But now let's even assume that the aid reached its intended beneficiaries. Then, if we're dealing in terms of marginal utility, you'd have to ask, honestly, truthfully, what is the marginal utility to you or I as an individual of avoiding starvation somewhere else in the world where we have no connection compared to enhancing our own lives here and now?
Taking into account September 11th or not?
Either way.
I'd much rather make the rest of the world more wealthy now than...
Well, you're assuming, you're introducing an element here, you're saying...
Well, no, it's an element that I discussed initially, which is national security and protecting our resources.
National security and protecting our resources. But look, suppose September 11th had not happened. Then the argument would simply be, we have to care for the starving people, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now, the question I want you to answer, I don't mean you personally, I don't want to put anyone on the spot. From the perspective of an individual, what has the higher marginal utility? The money he's paying for his dessert, his own dessert, or the rations to keep a starving person alive in Africa or Asia or wherever. And if it is keeping the starving person alive, then my question would be, why are you having the dessert? Why haven't you contributed the money to CARE or some other program?
Because as you said, we already do our $20 billion or whatever.
No, but do you think... I'm not contributing because we have the $20 billion of taxes. If the $20 billion of taxes weren't there, would the choice be any different?
According to your economics theory, the first night, yes.
Pardon me?
According to your theory, the first night, yes.
Of the first night?
Of class.
How's that?
Didn't you speak about when people make more money, they tend to create more wealth for other people and give more back to society?
Yes, they do. Through the market, not through... through charity. They can give some charity, but charity is not the solution for 5% of the world's population in the United States to support 40 or 50% of the world's population. If we're seriously concerned with poverty around the world, the solution would be to encourage people in these countries to adopt our system. They need to adopt our system. Then they could produce prosperity for themselves. But the idea that there is a justification, there is no justification from the point of view of the individual for him to give up his dessert to help others who have no connection with him. If he wants to voluntarily, that's fine, but what is required to get him to do it, since he doesn't want to do that voluntarily?
Initiation of force.
This is the initiation of force. You are compelled to pay the taxes or you go to jail. Now, the fact is, many people may think this is terrible and cruel, that an individual does not experience hunger in the stomach of someone else, especially a total stranger, the way he experiences it in his own stomach. You wouldn't experience hunger in the stomach of someone halfway across the world the way you would experience it in your own child or in your spouse. You might consider the alleviation of your own child's hunger or your own spouse's hunger as more important than the alleviation of your own. They are a necessary condition, hopefully, to your life and happiness. But that is not true of strangers, especially those that you have no connection with. You can wish them well, make some limited contribution, but the idea that there is an objectively greater gain from serving them than serving your own dessert or equivalent, I don't think that holds. And all of us demonstrate in our behavior, day in and day out, that that's not our values. Now, as for protecting national security by giving away food, I'm sorry to say that that sounds to me like, they won't attack us if we feed them. They are ready to fly planes into our buildings, poison the water supply, do God knows what. But if we feed them in Africa or wherever, they'll leave us alone. I don't think so. I think it would be much more plausible to say, well, maybe if we repeal the farm subsidies, we perhaps should add the $20 billion to national defense or something like that. Have more troops go in with better weapons and totally obliterate them. That would make... By me?
We don't need more money to do that. We could.
Well, see, an argument along those lines, I think, would be stronger. But the idea, they'll leave us alone if only we feed them.
I'm just saying it's a very common argument.
Well, I'm sure it is common. That is true. But I don't think it's a very sound argument.
How would you go about repealing
The farm subsidies?
That's the biggest stumbling block. I agree that the theory would hold, mm-hmm. but in reality, you have not a huge portion of our country, but you still have the farmers
there's the farmers.
A devastating loss.
Okay, let me try to make a connection. Maybe the basis won't seem clear, perhaps right away anyway. We had legislation in the last couple of years, I think it's the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, that CEOs have to sign off that they fully understand their company's accounting statements and they vouch for them. Well, why not? What would happen if we tried to apply similar standards to congressmen and senators? And we required that if they vote for a bill, they have to sign a document saying, A, they have read it and understood it, and are personally, sincerely for it, and that their vote has not been obtained by any form of payment, including the agreement of others to vote for their projects if they'll support projects that they don't personally support. Now, you see, that's very relevant to farm subsidies. The farmers presently amount to like 3.5-4% of the population. And how do they get the votes? Well, they have a significant block, but on their own, they couldn't do very much. So they will say, the members of the farm bloc will say, okay, perhaps to the steel industry, I don't know. The steel industry may have some votes it's bought and paid for, and other industries have their votes, and unions have their votes, and so on. And so one group will say, okay, we'll vote for your pet project, but you've got to vote for ours. And the members of each group genuinely support only their own specific projects, but they're in effect selling their votes in exchange for the return favor from the others. Well, to me, that sounds like bribery. And I would think that a serious requirement should be that any time a congressman votes, he has to be voting for the measure on the basis of his actual assessment of the measure as contributing to the public welfare or some kind of standard to the protection of individual rights, the freedom of the country, whatever, but not to be voting for something because someone else will vote for his pet project, and this particular thing is what he would not otherwise vote for. That's the sale of a vote. Now, if this sort of thing were a major issue, you could probably shame a lot of congressmen into these things. You could hold them up against their record. Why are they supporting this legislation? See, today it goes on openly. They make these deals all the time. But that should carry extreme moral opprobrium. And if that were the case, just think if the requirement were that before you vote for something, you have to understand what you're voting for. You have to sincerely believe that it does something objective. It's not in exchange to get something for you. It really is for the general well-being of the country. Well, what do you think that would do to something like farm subsidies? I think if that became accepted as the standard, it would wipe out such legislation. So, you see, there's more that would have to change. You can't act simply directly on the politics. You'd have to change the way people view the government, what they think its proper functions are. There's an awful lot to be done. It's doable. I don't expect to see it any longer in my lifetime. I don't have that many years left, but it would be achievable. Yes, Mr. Underwood.
During the Eisenhower administration, they repealed the farm subsidies.
No.
They did not.
No. Maybe they reduced some. There was nothing dramatic done. Maybe it was that era that saw the food stamp program. I'm not sure. Okay, so the point would be we'd expand the production of things that people wanted at the expense of things that they didn't want. That would be the long-lasting effect of the repeal of farm subsidies, not any change in the rate of profit. The changes in the rate of profit would be a temporary situation operating to transfer capital and labor out of agriculture into the rest of the economy. Then, as for rent control and controls on oil and gas, well, as I say, these are controls of an opposite character. They're fixing prices above which you're not allowed to sell. Right, let's try to analyze the abolition of rent control. What's the immediate effect of abolishing rent control on rents? Okay, they go up. And what about the profitability of rental housing? Okay, that goes up. So temporarily, landlords might be making extremely high profits. But if those profits are above the general average rate in the economy, what's going to be the effect on investment? Investment in rental housing increases, and then what's the effect on the supply of such housing and on rents?
More housing,
lower rents, and how far does this go? Pardon me?
Until the plenty of demand equals the supply.
Until it reaches a uniform profitability?
Yeah, until the rate of profit in rental housing comes down to the general level. But you see, notice, while it may be the case that the immediate effect of repealing rent controls is that profits on rental housing would be enormous, that will not be permanent. That will translate into a greater incentive and more means for stepped up investment in rental housing, which will increase the supply and bring rents down to the point where rental housing yields only the competitive rate of return. Now, the longer run effect of the repeal of rent control is that there's a larger supply of rental housing. It's not permanently more profitable. You just have a larger supply of rental housing. Then if we look at it in the still longer run, if you're a landlord, how can you increase your profitability given that there's no longer a scarcity of housing, the immediate scarcity reflected in the aftermath of rent control, that's now passed. How can an individual landlord make an exceptional rate of profit from his own properties?
Increase quality.
Okay, if he can improve what he offers, if he can find lower cost methods of providing it. Now, you might say, okay, here's a guy, he owns a building, a couple of buildings. What can he do about improving the methods of producing construction materials, building housing, maintaining it? Well, he personally may not be able to do very much at all. But what does any landlord want in the way of costs of maintaining his property? Higher costs or lower costs?
Lower costs.
When a landlord is contemplating erecting a building or making some improvement, would he want equally good but lower cost construction materials or higher cost construction materials? Lower, obviously. Now, the companies that produce the construction materials, the construction equipment, whatever, that produce boilers, electric wiring, paint, whatever, they know that their market, the landlords, wants to have the best quality at the lowest prices because that's what they need in order to be profitable. So that's what makes the companies producing the construction materials and construction equipment, etc., and the boilers and wiring and so on, that's what makes them, that motivates them to cut their costs and improve their quality. So this is how the process comes about. And then those landlords that are first to take advantage of the changes or that judge the market more correctly than others, they're in a position to make special profits. Suppose you have a market with growing income. The standard of living is rising. Most landlords are going about their accustomed methods. They're building buildings the way they always have, operating the way they always have. And now there's someone a little more intelligent, clever, sees an opportunity sooner. He recognizes that there's a large segment of the rental housing market that can afford something more. They would like to have not only a place to live, but also a swimming pool, maybe tennis courts, whatever, improved amenities. And so he offers that, a better, a higher level product. Well, if he judges the change in the state of the market correctly earlier than others, what's going to be the effect on his profit? He'll make a premium profit. This is a further way to make a premium profit, to anticipate changes in consumer demand ahead of others. It doesn't have to be that you introduce a new product or a more efficient method. There can be the same products and methods of production, but if demand is changing and you anticipate the direction in which it's changing and you're there with a supply to meet the demand, you'll do very well. In the years after World War II, those developers who estimated correctly that there'd be a huge growth in the suburbs and concentrated their efforts in the suburbs, they did very well because they were there where the additional demand was coming. And those that were concentrating on the downtown areas of cities, they did not do nearly as well. So judging changes in the market for whatever reason, that's a way to make special profits too. And then, of course, when everyone catches on, those special profits are gone. Now, the continuing very long-run effect of a free market in rental housing, we should expect to be what? In the light of the principles I've already presented.
Increased housing.
Increased housing, better quality housing. There should be more and better housing at lower real cost. And I think if you look around, you can see that. Generations ago, people would have a few rooms, perhaps, and they wouldn't even have electric wiring. Today, they certainly have electricity galore, refrigerators, air conditioners, all kinds of company amenities, swimming pools, tennis courts. The square footage per person, I'm sure, has significantly increased. And this is the dynamic aspect of the uniformity of profit principle. That you make profits by introducing improvements, more efficient methods. The special profit is eliminated by competition. Then you have to introduce further improvements, still further efficiencies.
Just out of curiosity, during the Industrial Revolution, when working inequalities were so low, why did it require the government to get involved in that, to be able to square that away?
Okay, you say in the Industrial Revolution, or the early years, why did it require the government to get involved? Well, nothing required the government to get involved. The government got involved because people's ideas were that the capitalists are growing rich at the expense of the poor. They thought that. Now, for centuries, people were much poorer. If you look at conditions in the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, the death rate was enormous. Life was short for those who survived childhood. If you had any kind of illness, just imagine you lost some teeth, you couldn't replace them, you broke an arm, it would be unlikely ever to be set properly. If you have visited third world countries and seen horribly poor people, how so many of them are stooped over, they have bad skin conditions, this is what life was like everywhere. And then when the Industrial Revolution began, for the first time in human history, there was some sustained improvement, and also for the first time, people started to become sensitive about the plight of those who weren't doing very well. If you were living in a society in which overwhelming poverty was the norm, people would be very desensitized to it. I suppose you were living in a place like Calcutta, the capital of Bangladesh. What kind of poverty do you think you'd be seeing around you?
Immense.
It'd be enormous. You'd see people dying of starvation in front of you. And this is what many, many people see day in and day out. And what kind of response do you think they have to it, most of them?
It's a normal part of the day.
Yeah, they're indifferent. They become indifferent. They accept it. That's a part of the background. Now, people began not to accept it when, for the first time, they realized that there was some realistic prospect of general improvement. And they began to realize that with the course of improvement in the Industrial Revolution. Now, it's certainly true, conditions were absolutely horrible. Real wages were miserably low. Working conditions were a nightmare. There was child labor. Everything was terrible. But what improved it was precisely these efforts of profit-seeking businessmen that started introducing new and improved products and more efficient methods of production. In the early years of the Industrial Revolution, for the first time in history, poor people could get some new underwear. You know, before the Industrial Revolution, you didn't have cotton textiles. Cotton textiles were the first industry of the Industrial Revolution. Before that, practically all clothing was wool. Wool cannot be washed very often. It destroys it. Clothing was worn second, third, and fourth hand. People were walking around lice-infested. And then for the first time, with the Industrial Revolution, you started getting mass production of textiles, and things like underwear and socks could be produced at prices that miserably poor people could afford. So one of the things that should be kept in mind is factory production did not appeal for a long time to the upper classes. When the upper classes want something, they typically want it custom made by hand. Factory production, when it began, could not be a very high quality, and its market was the masses. And still today, although things have radically improved, the main market for the major factories, for the major businesses, is the masses. Big business is production for the masses. It's not production for a small market of elite rich people. That's the market of special boutiques. But big business is producing for the masses. And as the productivity of labor rose, see, just think what we've established in connection with the uniformity of profit principle. What's it doing to the supply of goods? What's the uniformity of profit principle doing to the supply of goods? It's progressively increasing the supply of goods. And what's it doing to the supply of goods relative to the supply of labor? What's it doing to the output per worker? It's increasing it, right? So we have the supply of goods rising relative to the number of workers. Well, what implication do you think that has for prices relative to wages?
Increases.
It's decreasing prices relative to wages. Prices fall to the extent there's more goods. There's not that much more labor. there's much more additional goods than additional labor, so prices fall relative to wages. And what does that do to the buying power of wages? It increases the buying power. That raises real wages. That's how the standard of living rose. Now, this was not appreciated. You see, the way most people thought of profits and the profit motive, and still do, they think of it as stealing from the masses. They think that the profits are stolen from the masses and are making them poorer. But the reality is the profits are earned by increasing and improving production, and they're saved and reinvested and increase the means of production. It's the hated capitalist pigs who are responsible for the rise in the standard of living. But people did not believe that. They didn't know that. What they thought was the capitalist pigs are pigs, and they're destroying the standard of living of the average person, and so you need the government to go after them for the average person. That's the prevailing belief. So the government intervention came about not because any actual set of facts required it, but on the basis of the ideas that people held. And this is something we'll go into in much more detail in the last 2 weeks of the class. Now, these are ideas, I think, very, very different than what you're used to. I hope you can make some room for them, because I think they're logically demonstrable, and the alternatives are indefensible. Yes, Mr. Levy. Oh, the projector is off. Okay, thank you very much. Let me put it back on. Okay, now, with oil and natural gas, when the price controls were repealed, they were exceptionally profitable for a time. Then the production and supply increased, and the rate of profit came down to the going general rate. I'm going to jump ahead for considerations of time. I would like to say something about rents and prices in minority neighborhoods, but I'll just pass that by now to go to the tendency toward a geographical uniformity of prices. And I give you a statement of the principle. The price of a good capable of transportation tends to be the same throughout the world, plus or minus costs of transportation and tariffs, if any. So a good that's capable of being transported, such as cotton, wheat, iron, gold, silver, whatever, if it's capable of being transported, the principle holds that its price will tend to be the same throughout the world, plus or minus costs of transportation. Let's see why. The basis of the principle is similar to that of the uniformity of profit principle. Suppose we have a price of wheat in New Orleans and another price in Liverpool, England. Imagine the price in New Orleans is initially $1 a bushel. That in Liverpool were somehow $3 a bushel. And assume that the cost of transporting a bushel from New Orleans to Liverpool was 25 cents. Okay, if you can buy a bushel in New Orleans for $1, cover the 25 cent cost of transportation, what kind of profit are you looking at? $1.75 per bushel. All right, well, don't you think there are people around eager to jump at such a profit opportunity? Okay, and they would. Now, as they do, what is the effect on the demand for wheat or whatever in the low-priced market of New Orleans? What would be the effect on the demand as people are jumping in to buy in order to ship to Liverpool?
Demand goes up.
Okay, the demand in New Orleans goes up, and what's going to be the effect on the price in New Orleans?
Go up.
That'll go up. And what is the effect of the shipment of wheat from New Orleans to Liverpool on the supply in Liverpool?
It'll increase the supply.
It'll increase the supply in Liverpool, and what will be the effect on the price in Liverpool? It'll go down. So let's say we've reached the point where the price in New Orleans is now $1.75, and in Liverpool it's $2.50. So there's a 75 cent difference. Transportation cost is only 25 cents. Isn't there still a profit opportunity?
Yes.
Well, what will be the effect?
We'll continue until it's
There'll be more buying in New Orleans, more selling in Liverpool. The price in New Orleans will rise higher. The price in Liverpool will fall further until what is the difference? When will it cease to step up? When the transportation cost. If the price fails to allow for transportation cost, let's say the price difference were 15 cents a bushel, well, then wheat would not move from New Orleans to Liverpool. The price difference has to get to more than 25 cents for it to move, and will tend not to get much above 25 cents. So this is why the principle operates. And I say the basis of it is in the fact that it pays to buy in the cheaper market and sell in the dearer market, which has the effect of raising the price in the cheaper market and lowering it in the dearer market. Now, this principle has some significance and applications. One significant aspect is why in the modern world local crop failures no longer result in famines. Back in the Middle Ages, when markets were very, very narrow, confined, let's say, to a part of a province of a given country, suppose growing conditions were bad in a particular year, and the supply came in below normal. Well, what do you expect to happen to the price of something? It would shoot way up. You have an inelastic demand for necessities. Imagine. Let's do this on a national scale. Suppose the normal wheat supply in France, the wheat crop in France, comes in 50% below normal. So that's a halving of supply in France. If France were an isolated country and divorced from the world market, given the inelasticity of demand for wheat, what kind of rise in the price of wheat might we be looking at? Well, that would be a unit elastic demand. If it's inelastic, that means the quantity demanded falls much less than in, falls less than in proportion to the fall in supply. Supply is halved. In order to reduce the quantity demanded by 50%, you need far more than a doubling of price, maybe 10 times the price. And there'd be some people who would have to stop buying because they just didn't have the funds, and they might be dying of starvation. So that would be a famine situation. All right, but now, if you allow for the uniformity of price principle, what will happen once the price of wheat or anything else inside France or wherever gets above the outside price by more than the cost of inbound transportation? Then people start buying abroad, shipping it in, and when they buy abroad, the world market price goes up, but the domestic supply is replenished, and so what is the effect on the rise in the domestic price?
It's controllable.
Pardon me?
Will it go up?
Well, we know it's going up, but will it go up by a factor of 10? And what's the effect insofar as supplies come in from outside in response to the to a rise in price? The price in the domestic market will rise much less. It won't rise by a factor of 10. Let's try to understand by what kind of factor it would rise. See, if France were an isolated country, a 50% failure of its crop would mean a 50% reduction of supply, essentially. But if France is now part of a world market, and if we assume that French output only represents 5% of the world output of this item, and there's a 50% reduction of supply in France, 50% reduction in production in France, what kind of global reduction is 50% in France if France amounts to 5% of the world market?
2.5%.
Now, what this means is that when France becomes part of the world market, its 50% supply failure translates into a 2.5% global supply failure. Now, allowing for an inelastic demand for wheat, well, if there's a 2.5% reduction in supply, the price will rise more than in proportion, so maybe it rises 10%. We're looking at now a 10% rise in the world market price of wheat instead of a 900% rise. See, it's much smaller, because each country's production becomes a smaller fraction of the global production. Instead of being an isolated totality, it's now a fraction of a much larger global market. And that means that any given supply failure on a local level translates into a much smaller event. Now, to what extent would the price rise in France? Instead of rising on the strength of a 50% supply reduction, it'll rise on the strength of what? Oh, there's a 2.5% supply reduction. Now, actually, it could rise somewhat more than that. If it were the case that France was neither importing nor exporting wheat beforehand, but now they'll have to import it, and so in addition to the 2.5% rise in the world market price, they'll also have to pay to cover the cost of inbound transportation. If before they didn't have to do that, that will also add to the price. If before the failure they were an exporting country, if they were exporting, that would mean what about the price in France compared to the places to which they were exporting? While they were exporting, the price in France would be lower than in the areas to which they were exporting by outbound transportation costs. You see, why would France export wheat to Britain unless the price were higher in Britain than in France by enough to cover transportation costs? Yes. Now, if France has to go from the role of an exporter to an importer, then the rise in price could, in effect, reflect double transportation costs. They no longer have the lower price of, they no longer have the discounted price, and they have to pay the world market price plus inbound transportation costs instead of the world market price minus their outbound transportation costs. Yes, Mr. Levy.
So the step off of grain,
excuse me?
The step off of grain as a commodity, let's take another commodity like lumber.
Yeah.
Wouldn't the argument, I'll open-ended question, I'll phrase this as an open-ended question. Wouldn't the excess that would be fed to an export market, wouldn't there be an additional variable that if they fed it to its domestic market, it might oversaturate and create a higher level of supply over demand to affect the price, which would be why they would separated into the international market?
Well, see, the reason that exporting takes place is always that it's more profitable to export than to sell domestically.
But the variable that you support that with was because the prices were the variable that caused that.
Yeah.
Whereas it seems it's ignoring the effect of oversaturation.
Yeah, well, what would be, if there were more supply, if more supply were fed into the domestic market, what would happen to prices in order to find buyers?
Well, they would go down.
The prices would have to go down. So before prices go down very far, people see that it's better to export.
So it's intrinsically tied to the...
Yeah, it's always an issue of price. Okay. Now, this is why you can see that a country no longer need fear such a thing as a famine from a local crop failure. I want to make a further application. It's conceivable that this could have some application in the years ahead. I'm sometimes criticized for bringing up this example because it occurred roughly 30 years ago now. But I want an illustration of something, and fortunately we don't have these things going on every day. We should be grateful that the kind of example I'm going to give you last occurred on the order of 30 years ago and is not an everyday occurrence, but as I say, could be again. Back in the fall of 1973, the Arab members of OPEC launched an oil embargo against the United States because the U.S. was siding with Israel, and they refused to send oil here. And the result, this was followed by major chaos in the United States. There were shortages of oil, gasoline, all the oil products. It was really a nightmare. I don't know if any of you have personal recollections of this. I see some people with gray hair, so maybe they do. But you'd have to get on a line of cars, maybe wait an hour or more before you could pull up to the pump at a gas station and hope they weren't out of gas.
And they had to do odd and even days.
And then they had odd even days to limit how many people would be looking for gas on a given day. So that existed in many places. Now, at the time, the United States was getting roughly 6% of its oil from the OPEC countries. We were importing an amount of oil equal to about 6% of our overall supply from OPEC, but that was concentrated very heavily in New England and the Middle Atlantic states. Roughly 25% of their consumption was coming from OPEC, the Arab members of OPEC. Now, let's try to run through the course of events of an embargo where suddenly there's 25% less oil coming to New England and the Middle Atlantic states. What would happen in a free market to the price of oil and oil products in that area? I mean, they would shoot up quite high, but would there be anything limiting their rise along the lines of the rise in the price of wheat in France in the face of a crop failure?
Supply of the surrounding area.
Pardon me?
Supply of the surrounding area that could feed it.
Okay, we have supplies of oil elsewhere in the country. We have the Midwest, the South, the Far West. What would happen as soon as the price of oil and oil products in the Northeast got above the price of the same products in the Midwest and South by more than the cost of transportation from the Midwest and South? Okay, then the oil and oil products would move from the Midwest and South into the Northeast, and there'd be a movement from the West into the Midwest and South. So instead of the 25% reduction in supply remaining in the Northeast, that supply reduction would very largely be made good by drawing on supplies from the rest of the country. In other words, the effect would be to spread the supply reduction out over the United States as a whole rather than concentrate it in the Northeast. And this would occur by virtue simply of the rise in price in the Northeast. Now, going still further, what would be the effect if the price of oil in the United States as a whole now gets above the price in non-Arab countries by more than cost of transportation from them, like Venezuela, Nigeria, Indonesia? There are a lot of sources of oil outside of the Arab states in OPEC. What do you think would be the effect on the movement of supply from those places to the United States? Okay, we'd have additional supplies coming from them. So this raises the question, to what extent should an embargo by a limited class of producers be able to reduce the supply in the target country? It should not have such a big impact. Because A, the supply reduction would be spread out over the country as a whole, and B, much of it would be made good by stepped up imports from elsewhere. And if we look at this further, and we recognize that oil is a global commodity, to what extent are the members of OPEC in a position actually to raise the world market price? They can raise it to the extent that they bring about a reduction in the world supply of oil. They're in a position to do that to some extent, but only to the extent that they reduce the world supply of oil could they raise the world market price. Now, which country do you think, if there is a reduction in the global supply of oil, to what extent do you think the United States in particular would be in a position where it would have to absorb most of that reduction?
Not most.
So just think, which countries would have to cut back more heavily? Okay. Here's the United States, with among the very highest per capita incomes in the world. Then there are many, many poorer countries. So if there's a lesser supply of oil, who do you think is going to bear the brunt of the supply reduction in a free market? Other countries, not the United States. The brunt of it would be in the poorer countries. So the implication is that the Arab members of OPEC would not be in a position to do very serious damage to the United States in a free market. Now, a further point, If they don't reduce the world supply of oil, if they just don't want to sell to us, but they chose to sell what they had been selling to us to others, I suppose they say, okay, we're not shipping oil to these terrible Yankee pigs or whatever, but we'll sell that oil in Europe and Japan. Do you think they'd be able to raise the world market price of oil at all?
Not beyond transportation.
No, they wouldn't be. See, a good analogy that I use in the book is putting water in an ice tray, and the kind of ice tray that has a removable insert to form the cubes. Now, these removable plastic inserts, they're certainly not watertight. And imagine we think of one of the compartments as the United States. And OPEC introduces a medicine dropper and will extract a medicine dropper full of water from the compartment labeled United States, the ice cube compartment labeled United States. Do you think they're able to reduce the water level in the U.S. compartment by the amount they take out with the eyedropper?
No.
Why not?
Other companies are imported in here.
Because the water will flow from the surrounding compartments. There's a tiny, for an instant, a nanosecond or less, there's less water in the U.S. compartment. That means lower water pressure than in the surrounding compartments. The water will move from the areas of higher pressure to lower pressure in the process, equalizing the pressure throughout the tray. Well, the uniformity of price principle is similar. Reducing the supply in the U.S. Temporarily raises the price in the U.S. relative to prices in surrounding areas, and supplies will move in the process, raising prices outside, lowering the price in the U.S. And if OPEC took the medicine dropper full of water from the U.S. compartment and now dropped it into the Japanese or West European compartment, would they reduce the water in the U.S. compartment at all? No. Only to the extent they reduce the global supply are they in a position to raise the price. Now, the implication of this is an embargo would not be such a terrible disaster, the kind of disaster that we actually experienced. What made it such a disaster? Because what made it a disaster is that when the embargo occurred, thanks to President Nixon, we had price controls on oil and oil products. The price controls were imposed in August of 1971 as part of a general 90-day freeze on prices. Practically all other controls were lifted, but for some reason the controls on oil were retained and oil products. And this meant that when the OPEC embargo hit, it was against the law for prices in New York and New England to go up. Well, if it's against the law, then how do people in New York and New England and the surrounding areas, what can they do to make it more profitable to supply them, to bring supplies in from elsewhere? They can't do anything. They're paralyzed by the government. And that's why the brunt of the supply reduction not only fell there initially, but remained there. The system was paralyzed, was prevented from a response. And the United States as a whole was not in a position to step up its imports by offering a higher price than elsewhere. As a matter of fact, while we froze the price, OPEC did reduce the world supply. The world supply of oil was reduced, and the price rose significantly, very sharply, in markets like Rotterdam and Yokohama. And that made those areas more profitable than the United States. And so you can be sure, instead of picking up replacement supplies from non-Arab OPEC sources like Venezuela, Nigeria, etc., we undoubtedly lost further supplies. Their supplies would be diverted to places like Europe and Japan, where prices were allowed to rise, rather than the United States, where they were frozen. And at the same time, the profit incentive of our own oil companies was what? If you were an oil company and you could get away with it, where would you want to sell your oil that you had normally sold in the domestic market? Sell it abroad, export it at where the price is higher. Now, I don't think that happened to any great degree because the companies were too afraid to try to do that, unless they knew there would be great retaliation from the government. But that was their profit incentive. And when you have price controls on domestic output and a higher world price. Now, I won't even go into the export of Alaskan oil to Japan in the interest of time. If by some miracle we cover everything, we can go back to some of these things.
How did that embargo get lifted?
How did it get lifted? Well, at some point the Arabs relented, but that wasn't what solved the problem. The worst aspects of the situation were overcome around April of 1974. See, up to that time, the government was simply controlling prices in the United States, and they had no way to control prices outside the United States. So if oil is controlled in the United States, let's say at under $10 a barrel, and it's above that outside the United States, we're not going to import very much. Well, in April of 74, they changed the price control formula in a very important way. They adopted a weighted cost base with respect to crude oil. Domestic production was still price controlled. I think at that time, domestically produced crude oil was controlled at about $5 something a barrel. And imported oil, which we could not control imported oil, and we were importing altogether on the order of half of our oil. And the half that was imported was factored in at uncontrolled world market prices. So if oil is selling at $10 a barrel outside the United States, but $5 a barrel if it's domestically produced, the price control authorities took the attitude the weighted cost average of a barrel of crude oil would be about $7.50. Half at $10, half at $5. So the weighted cost average was $7.50. And they allowed the price of oil products to be set on a cost base of $7.50. So this meant the price of oil and oil products was now high enough to cover the uncontrolled world price. So now we started importing significant quantities of oil again. We stepped up our imports. And then at some point, the OPEC embargo was lifted as well. But it really wasn't the OPEC embargo that did us the great harm, and its lifting wasn't the thing that solved the problem. Okay, well now we're at this other principle that we've already touched upon, the tendency toward a uniformity of prices over time. And I basically explained this principle, I think. If something is storable, the prospective future price will not be able to exceed the price in the present by more than the costs of storage plus an allowance for the going rate of return on the capital that needs to be tied up. So if soybeans are $5 a bushel today and their prospective price in the future were $10, it would pay to buy soybeans at $5, store them, incur the storage costs, so long as you can make a minimum a proper rate of return. And the effect of this additional buying is to raise the spot price, the current price, increase the supplies available for the future, and reduce the future price. And you can see that there's a definite pattern of futures prices. They're all related. The prospective future prices will tend to equal the present prices plus cost of storage plus an allowance for the rate of return. Now, if there's a harvest, then in the harvest month, the price, the future price for the harvest month can suddenly plunge. The principle is not that prospective future prices can't be lower than present prices, but they cannot be higher than present prices by more than the cost of storage together with an allowance for the going rate of return. And if you follow weather reports, if the orange juice crop is coming in and there's fear of a frost in Florida or wherever they're growing large quantities of oranges, what will that do to the price of orange juice futures and the current cash price of orange juice, concentrated orange juice? it'll immediately increase it, because people will be, the speculators will be judging. If this hurts the crop, then the price is going to be higher. And so immediately the present price jumps up, because it'll be more valuable in the future. Now, suppose it turns out that the frost has not materialized, then what happens? Then the price will come back down. So anything that can affect the demand or the supply over a period of some considerable time ahead is factored into the current or cash price. And this has application to price controls. Under B, I refer to the mitigation of scarcities. Suppose it looks like the crop is going to be poor. Maybe locusts are appearing, or God knows what, or there hasn't been adequate rainfall, or there's too much rain, or whatever. Anything is going on that is likely to reduce the size of the crop. What would be the effect on the cash price of the same item, on the existing supplies?
Pardon me?
It'll get increased in response to the prospectively higher price in the future. Now, as the price increases in the current cash market, what is the effect of that on quantity demanded, on the rate of current consumption? It'll decrease it. And what does it do to supplies that are held available to meet the greater need in the future? That's increased. So what is the effect of this on the extent to which prices rise in the future, compared with the speculators not having acted? If the speculators didn't act, then supplies would not be held from the present into the future. There'd be no rise in the present, but the item would be scarcer in the future, and prices would be higher in the future. Now, if it's anticipated, let's suppose that it's anticipated the crop is not going to be horrendously below normal. It'll be below normal by an amount equal to 1 month's normal consumption, 1/12, 8 1/3%. If that is anticipated early on, before the crop has even come in, what will be the effect on the price immediately?
Slight increase.
Okay, it'll increase, conforming to this 8 1/3% below normal supply. And what will be the effect of that on the rate of consumption throughout the year? There'll be a decrease in the consumption over the year. The price will rise sufficient to reduce consumption equal to the reduction in supply. Now, it's not a stupendous reduction in supply. It's 8 1/3%, 1 month's consumption. So we see the intensity of the scarcity is mitigated because it's spread out over a full year. But what if when the scarcity were recognized and the price starts to rise, we had a price control? As people were saying, why should these greedy speculators be able to profit on an act of God? God has decided to give us a smaller crop. Why should these greedy speculators be allowed to profit from this and raise the price of the people's bread? Well, what would happen if we follow this and the price doesn't go up? If the price doesn't go up, what will happen to the rate of consumption? It'll stay the same. And where will we be if it stayed the same for 6 months, and now in 6 months we've consumed 6 months' normal supplies, and now we have 6 months left with 5 months' supplies? If the price control is repealed at that point, to what extent will the price have to rise? It'll have to rise much more, because now you have to curtail consumption not by 8 1/3%, but by 16 2/3%. So the longer you have the price control on, the more you're concentrating the supply reduction into a shorter time, and the higher will be the rise. There's an analogy again to physics. If you're holding your finger over the hose and water is coming out, the more you block the area over which the water can come out, what happens to the pressure with which it comes out in the area that it can come out? It's correspondingly increased. Well, the shorter the time we allow for the adjustment, the higher must be the rise in price. And this is one of the reasons why when you have an era of inflation coupled with price controls, especially on-again, off-again price controls, you'll find stupendous spikes in prices anytime the controls are lifted, because they're concentrating to make up the effects. Okay, let us turn to yet another major principle, similar to the uniformity of price principles. And this is the tendency toward a uniformity of wage rates for labor of the same degree of ability. And I should add, in the same labor market, in the same labor market. And again, the basis of the principle is very similar to that of the other principles. We can start off with radically unequal wage rates. But what sort of wage rates do workers prefer, higher or lower?
Higher.
Obviously higher. And we can be absolutely certain of that, I think. So now, if we have unequal wage rates for labor of the same degree of ability, we have higher wage rates being offered for jobs that people in lower paying jobs could do or could learn to do, what development should we expect? Shouldn't we expect an increase in the supply of labor in the higher paying fields and a decrease in the lower paying fields? Because there will be a movement of supply. Well, what will be the effect of more people coming to take the higher paying jobs and fewer people remaining to take the lower paying jobs? What effect will that have on the wage rates?
Okay,
there'll be an increase in the supply of people in the higher paying lines, which will have what effect on wage rates in those initially higher paying areas?
It'll
bring them down.
And the lower paying wages,
and the lower paying areas would go up, because there's a movement of supply, just like the movement of capital from the lower profit to the higher profit industries, reduce the higher profits, raise the lower profits, the movement of a commodity from the lower priced area to the higher priced area, brought down the higher price, raised up the lower price. But you have the same thing in labor. Now I make a point here in point one after the semicolon that this is accomplished mainly by a movement in the supply of young workers entering the labor force. Because if you're looking at 40 and 50-year-old workers in a particular line that they're used to for many, many years, well, let's say they could earn 20% more in some other occupation. But that would require extensive retraining. Probably many, many of these workers would not be willing to go to the trouble. They'd be content to continue with the lower-paying work rather than learn something totally new. So we can grant that. The older workers are not too likely to move. If there were huge differences, the bigger the difference, the greater the movement would be. But for relatively modest differences, we shouldn't expect much movement. But what about the younger workers? See, realize every line, every occupation is always losing members to death and retirement. And for its ranks to be maintained, it needs young workers entering the field all the time. Well, how will the flow of young workers be affected by the disparities? The flow of younger workers will run more heavily to the higher paying lines, less heavily to the lower paying lines, and that will bring about the changes in supply. That's what will achieve it. Now, in point two, I refer to a corollary tendency toward unequal wage rates for labor of different degrees of ability. This principle of a tendency toward equal wage rates, that refers to labor of the same degree of ability. But we have people of very unequal degrees of ability. Now, I think these degrees of ability are probably pretty well set in most cases by the time people are 15, 16, maybe even younger than that. Let's look at young workers and soon-to-be workers in this age bracket. And now some of them have limited potential. Many of them have very limited potential. Perhaps the majority, or a great many of them, certainly a very high percentage, will not be able to become more than an unskilled worker. There's a further group that is capable of becoming skilled workers. Let's say one group is defined by the limit of its ability is to work in a factory or drive a bus. There's another group that has the potential to learn some skilled trade. And then there's a third group that has the potential to pursue various professions, doctors, lawyers, whatever. Now, I think it's the case that, at least by and large, not in each and every instance, but on the whole, that there cannot be very much movement from the ranks of those who by the age of 15 or 16 have defined themselves as not being able to do more than unskilled work. There can't be much of a movement of supply from that group into the supply of skilled workers, and not much of a movement from the group that is capable of skilled work going into the professions. So there's a kind of dichotomy, or perhaps that's not the right word. There are grades in the labor market, at least three, maybe more than three. At least we can distinguish between unskilled, skilled, and professional level workers, and perhaps some more than that. Now, the way that the uniformity of wage rate principle would apply, I think, is at least at three distinct levels. There is a tendency for the wage rates of unskilled workers to be equalized at one level. And there can still be further factors, too, that we'll get to. But let's say there's one tendency toward an equalization of the wage rates of unskilled workers among the different occupations. So factory workers and bus drivers should earn comparable wages. There's another tendency toward an equalization of wages at a higher level among skilled workers. So plumbers and electricians should be tending to earn comparable wage rates. And there is a further tendency toward equalization at a still higher level among engineers, architects, doctors, dentists, and attorneys. Now, this is subject even to still further modification, but we have at least these three different levels. Now, why is it the case that if professionals are making, let's say, 20 times what an unskilled worker is making, why don't the unskilled workers say, hey, look what my doctor is making, look what I'm making, I'll be a doctor. They not only don't have the education, more fundamentally than that, they don't have the prerequisites of acquiring the education. They don't have the brains that can absorb it. I think there are some exceptions. You might have some people who, for psychological reasons, have not developed themselves. Maybe someone is working as a ditch digger, and if he changed his life around, maybe he could be a great surgeon. Such things may happen in one in a million cases. So it's not absolutely impossible, but it's highly unlikely. And I think the stratification is perhaps largely based on IQ. If it takes, let's say, 130 IQ and up to be in the professions, I don't know just where the number would lie, but you can do a skilled job with an IQ of 110, and for the rest, anyone with an IQ above 70 can do an unskilled job. There's going to be this stratification of the labor market with at least three different levels of equalization. And then, of course, we'd have to modify this further. In many, many lines, there are star performers, people with unique combinations of abilities, like an outstanding baseball player, a brilliant actress, or whatever. And these people can have earnings far, far above the average of their profession. A run-of-the-mill opera singer can't say, well, look at Pavarotti's income. He earns so much more than I do. I will sing like Pavarotti. Why not? He just doesn't have it. There's only one Pavarotti. So if you have unique characteristics and there's a demand for your services, your income can be higher without any fixed limit. The only thing that will limit it is what's high enough to limit the quantity demanded to the volume of services you're able and willing to supply. So we can allow for stars who are getting stupendous incomes, but more importantly, we have at least these three different levels. And there is yet a further significant principle, point three, premiums and discounts in wages, accompanying, for the most part, non-monetary disadvantages and advantages of employment. And this would be similar to the point brought out earlier, the special premium profit that a drug pusher might make, because he has tremendous risks and there's social opprobrium connected with what he's doing. Well, it doesn't have to be that extreme, but let's look at unskilled workers. Suppose the wages of driving a bus and working in the sewers were equal. How many takers do you think you'd have for the sewer jobs?
People that don't have a license.
Pardon me?
People that can't drive a bus.
Well, if they can't drive a bus, but anyone who could do practically anything else would not be a candidate. And if in the sewers, you need some people at least who could drive buses, what would you have to do to induce them not to be a bus driver and to work in the sewers instead? You have to offer them a premium. They have to offer a premium to overcome the filth and odiousness of that kind of work. So anytime there is any kind of negative accompanying a job, other things being equal, it will have to offer a premium in wages to induce people to be willing to put up with the negative element. Now, it doesn't have to be just a negative of this kind. If a job is particularly dangerous, in order to get people to do it, there'd have to be some special compensation. If a job is irregular, if you can't count on being employed so often in that job, in the times in which you are employed, you'll have to earn more in order to get people to devote themselves to it. Yes?
In Iraq, they pay 10-20% higher to drive those trucks than they would be.
I think even more than that. I was just reading an article in today's paper. Thank you for mentioning that. It was mentioning that there are quite a few truck drivers over in Iraq, so many of them from the U.S., and they're getting paid double what they would get here. I don't think that's unreasonable. You go there, they have a good chance of being blown up, beheaded, whatever. So that sort of thing requires a considerable premium. That's a good example. Thank you for mentioning it. If one occupation requires considerably more preparation than another, like if we turn now to physicians and attorneys, it may be somewhat of a stretch to assume that most people who go into law would also have the ability to go into medicine, but probably some significant number of them do. Why would physicians almost necessarily have to earn significantly more than attorneys? Can you think of anything that would require, in order to have an adequate supply of physicians, that they earn more than attorneys? Pardon me?
Malpractice.
Well, there's malpractice. That's relatively recent, but that's after you deduct the malpractice premiums. That's not net income. Put malpractice aside. Why, even before the days of malpractice being a significant issue, could we expect physicians to have to earn more than attorneys? There's significant more time in education. You can be an attorney, even if you have to go to 4 years of college, okay, 3 years of law school, a year to study for the bar exam, and then you're up off and running as an attorney. Years ago, you didn't even have to finish college. When I was in college, it was possible to go from your sophomore year, after your sophomore year, into law school, or junior year. So it wasn't even as much as it is today. But to be a physician, you have to go through college, 4 years of medical school, an internship, and then several years of residency. So it's a significantly longer training period and a shorter practicing period. So if everything else were equal, if they were earning equal wages, physicians would be at a significant disadvantage. Physicians need to earn more than attorneys, at least to the extent of covering the higher costs of training, the shorter periods of being out in practice. So that's an element. So we have at least three principles governing wage formation. The tendency toward equal wage rates at the same level of ability, modified by premiums and discounts for any negative, and also I should mention discounts for a positive. If a job is considered particularly soft and cushy, if it were offering the same wage rates as other jobs, what would be the supply of people looking to get it?
Higher.
It would have a greater supply. So what is the effect of that on the wage rates in any kind of job perceived as soft and cushy? They'll go to a discount. So if there's a non-monetary positive, the wages will be lower. If there's a non-monetary negative, the wages will be higher. If there's a higher monetary cost of some kind, the wages will be higher. And then we have these inequalities of wages at different levels of skill and ability. Now, an important implication of this is that the consumers are the parties ultimately responsible for controlling the relative size of the various occupations. Just imagine that the consumers, for whatever reason, decided they wanted more literature, they wanted to buy more books and magazines, and a smaller quantity of products made of wood. How would this affect the demand for printers versus carpenters? I mean, the more demand for printers, less demand for carpenters. How would that affect the relative wages of printers versus carpenters? Okay, printers would go up, the carpenters would go down. How would that affect the supply of young workers entering the two fields? Okay, the number of printers would be greater, the number of carpenters would be smaller. So the consumers, by a change in their pattern of buying and abstention from buying, would bring about a change in the relative size of these occupations, just as they bring about changes in the relative size of the various industries. Now, suppose we have a case where the consumers are changing their pattern of buying, and the labor is not able to move. Imagine the consumers, for whatever reason, were buying more products requiring skilled labor and fewer products requiring unskilled labor. And the unskilled workers are simply lack the capability of becoming the skilled workers. So there can't be a movement of supply.
Prices would go up.
Okay, what would be the effect, Mr. Zink? Yes?
The prices would go up.
The price of what?
The services or goods that they wanted that required that.
Okay, the wages of skilled workers,
yeah,
they'd go up. The prices of goods and services, to the extent they required skilled labor, would go up.
Yeah.
What about the wages of the unskilled workers? They would go down. And the cost and prices of goods and services, to the extent that unskilled labor was required, they'd go down. Well, I think the implication of this example is that it's ultimately the consumers who are responsible for the determination of the relative wages of skilled versus unskilled versus professional level labor. Now, in our conditions, that is not the only factor. We have artificial inequalities as well. These are necessary market-based inequalities, but then there are artificial inequalities also. To the extent that the supply of a profession is held below what it would normally be in a free market, the wages of the people in that occupation will be higher, and the wages of people in other occupations will be lower. Let me ask you this question. What do you think is the effect of medical licensing on the ratio of the incomes of physicians to the incomes of gardeners? What is the effect of medical licensing on the ratio of the income of the average physician to the income of the average gardener?
It guarantees
the income of the physician is elevated because physicians are made scarcer than they would otherwise be. And not that the people who would have been physicians become gardeners, but the ratio is elevated just by the rise in the income of the physicians. The wages of the gardeners, we could assume, are unchanged. And there'll be some wages that will be somewhat lower. People who might otherwise have been physicians will have to find alternatives. Maybe some of them would be pharmacists. Maybe some of them would be pharmaceutical company representatives or whatever. Or go into totally different lines. But there'll be some effect. Now, it's curious to me that people who are upset about inequality of income, they always seem to focus on market-based inequalities, but I think there are significant imposed artificial inequalities, notably licensing legislation of any kind and labor union legislation. Labor union legislation raises the wages of the union members, but what's it do to the number of them who can be employed? It reduces it, and where do those people have to go? To other jobs, which can only absorb them at lower pay. Okay, a last point here. I say seeking the highest paying job means trying to do what the consumers most want you to do. Well, to the extent that it's the consumer preferences that are governing the relative wage rates, and they're making some wage rates higher and others lower, and you're seeking to earn the best you can, you're implicitly following their preferences. Okay, I think we'll have to stop here, and our first order of business next week will be the connection between prices and costs, and then going into the general pricing of goods and services in limited supply. I hope you found at least some of this material enlightening. I find it enlightening every time I present it, but I know that is not the universal response. I will probably retire from teaching and still not know why that's not a wider response. Okay, have a good week. See you all next week.